Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome back to our weekly program, Soundbites, as we look at the future of food, agriculture, and our environment here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. This weekend is once again the Future Harvest CASA Conference on Sustainable Agriculture. It's 15th annual conference, Farming for Profit and Stewardship Conference, being held this week in College Park. You can find more information about that at futureharvestcasa.org, CASA.org. And there's going to be a panel there of people who were part of the founding of this Future Harvest, talking about where farming was then and where it is now when it comes to sustainable farming. And we are joined by people, some folks who will be on that panel and some who won't. Errol Maddox is with us, joining us by phone, actively involved in the sustainable farming community. We'll be speaking on the Founding Farmers panel at the Farming for Profit and Stewardship Conference this weekend. Joining us from the Eastern Shore, Errol, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Good morning. It's good to be back with you.
Denzel Mitchell's in studio, founder of Five Seeds Farm and Apiary in Baltimore City and County. Good to have you back here.
Good to see you, Mark.
And Amanda Behrens is with us, manager for the Center of Livable Futures Maryland Food System Mapping Project that we partner with here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. Future Harvest CASA board member and newly engaged. Congratulations on your engagement.
Thanks, Mark.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Email us or tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump onto our Facebook pages. So this particular panel, I think is important because 15 years, when you think 15 years back to the of where farming was and where sustainable farmers were at that moment, is a different place than where it is now in terms of on many levels, which we'll get to. I'd like you to – were you there at the beginning, Amanda?
I was not. Yeah.
You were there at the beginning, Errol.
Yes. At night at the very first meeting, I think I – was at the second meeting, and it was a rather small group, to say the least, at that time.
So, talk a bit about that. I mean, what was going on then? I'm curious what you thought 15 years ago when you thought about small sustainable farming, small in terms of the large conglomerate farms that exist and CAFOs that exist all around us. What was your vision at that moment?
The way I normally describe it is, at that time, everyone in the who was there was what I fondly referred to as long-haired hippie freaks. groups of folks who had an interest in local food, in good food. One of the reasons I became involved way back when was that I like food, I like to eat, I like to cook. The concept of making food available to a larger audience was part of the thought process, but it was extremely difficult. We did not have a Whole Foods in those days. The concept of organic food was like weird and strange. It was a group of folks with a vision on how they were going to change what was happening.
And I'm over the years, and you weren't there at the beginning, Amanda, but you've been following this. I mean, so this what do you all think is this trajectory now from that moment? We're talking about 16 years ago, 15 years ago, 1998, right?
Mm-hmm.
To think that it was that short a period of time ago, and now this explosion of small farming has taken place all over the country and all over our region, in cities, in suburbia, and in rural areas. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the main things, like Errol said, it was kind of a small group of people that were interested, and now it's becoming mainstream that people care about where their food comes from. And we're finding that while we maintain to be a farming organization for farmers, there are consumers that want to support us, and other people in the food system, distributors and processors that want to get into the discussion and the movement too. So it's just growing in every direction, which is wonderful. We hope to see that continue on the next 15 years.
And you've been at it how many years now as a farmer? Five?
It's about 5 years, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, like me, many other people just feeling inspired by what's happened in their communities. And in many ways, it's a hearkening back traditional. For me, I know for sure it was harkening back to how food was transpired in the house with my grandparents and with my aunts and uncles. And
who were farmers in Oklahoma.
Yeah. My aunts were farmers in Oklahoma, and right. They were homesteaders, and they were completely self-sufficient. And so there was a direct line from the food that we were eating to what was being served on the table. And, you know, I wanted to continue that when I felt like I had the opportunity and the capability to do that. And I've more or less driven myself to gain that knowledge, because it's you know, one of the things I think is really interesting about this is that it's not easy to get that knowledge. So, you know, you kind of have to go on a quest on your own. And, you know, Future Harvest has helped out with that a lot.
Future Harvest CASA has been that place that has been trying to help teach farmers and bring farmers together to mm-hmm. learn how to make a business, how to make this viable. I mean, and Errol, when you all started this like 15 years ago, and folks even began before that, the notion of what did it mean to be viable at that moment as opposed to what it means now?
It was, I don't believe, if my memory is correct, viability was not, that word was not used. It was not part of the discussion. It was, this is what I love, this is what I do. I think all of us at that time, the goal was to pay the bills. If I earn enough money to pay my bills with what I'm doing, what I love, I'm okay in the smallest sense. But what my goal was to make money, and that's in my day job, that's what I do, is I say I help farmers make money, because if you are not making money, you cannot continue on the process. And there are a number of folks in Maryland and Delaware and members and also members of Future Harvest CASA who earn 70, 80, or 90% of their income from their farming operation, which is approaching where the conventional farmers are, because most of the conventional farmers do not earn 100% of their income from their farming. So, and as Amanda noted, sustainability is a mainstream word for the majority of the people in this country. Folks want to know where their food comes from, and they're willing to pay to receive it. And actually, they are asking for it. The mega store Walmart's responding to the demand from, you know, Susie and Joe America to have local food in their stores. So it is becoming mainstream. And in 15 years down the road, I believe we will have probably 60 to 70% of what we can produce being produced in our food shed. No, we're not going to produce bananas and, you know, coconuts. But foodstuffs that we can grow here, most of it will be grown here, processed here and consumed here instead of importing it from other states.
Well, I want to come back to that very point and talk about the possibility and viability of what you just described that many people are kind of wrestling with at this moment. In your mapping project, Amanda, mm-hmm. That we're really happy to be part of, how many farms are we talking about in the state of Maryland? Do you have a sense of what we're talking about, the breadth of what we call sustainable farming, what that means?
Well, sustainable farming, conventional farming throughout the state, we have over 8,000 farms, according to the Census of Agriculture. But I think sustainable farming is probably maybe 25% of that. There's a lot of room for growth within the state. And I think this focus now on viability is really important to growing the movement, because if we want new young people to get into farming, we need to make sure that it's actually a viable, sustainable business for them. So we've covered that. We have a whole track on the business of farming at the conference to kind of grapple with this of how to make it work for new and young farmers and for people who just want to transition out of conventional and try something new and different, potentially more profitable.
So going back to what Errol just raised, I mean, I've heard other people say this. The last time we had a meeting, people were talking about what it means that the idea that Maryland and this region could become a breadbasket for the state and for a region where not only can farmers make a living, but people can buy food. What does that really mean? I mean, because right now most of our food is trucked in via Sysco and other things who bring us food from all over, and supermarkets where we buy our food, and people are used to buying food because it's subsidized by large kind of industrial farms around the country. We're used to buying food very inexpensively, right?
Right.
The chicken most people buy is $2.50, $3 a pound as opposed to $5 or $6 a pound, or eggs being $5 a dozen as opposed to being $2.50 a dozen. You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
So what do we mean by viability? How do you envision this actually happening?
Well, if I can...
Errol, go ahead.
Address that, Mark. I believe that as we scale up and that there are folks who will be producing on more than a half an acre, when we build infrastructure that is missing completely, we have no process. We have in the state of Maryland, there's one corn processor in Queen Anne, Maryland. They can corn. When we can have processing, which extends obviously the shelf life, we will have more people involved in the business. When we have the ability to transport, one of our major problems now is aggregating. We may have, on the shore where I live, we may have, as an example, we have lots of folks growing tomatoes, but they have to drive to Jessup. So hauling, 10 boxes of tomatoes is not economical. When we can reach the point where we can aggregate and develop that infrastructure to move 10 pallets instead of 10 boxes, that's going to push the price down. Well, you mentioned poultry. We have no private processors of poultry in the state of Maryland.
And what does that mean? What does that mean for us? What do you mean, no private processors? What does that mean?
Which means if you're you have Mark's poultry operation in Anne Arundel County, unless you process those 50 chickens a day or a week on your farm, you can't sell them. I mean, they're not available. That's one of the reasons the price is so high. So if we can develop that infrastructure, so as an example, you have 50 people growing 100 chickens a week, and they can take them to a commercial viable processor who can put them into the food system instead of the locally produced chicken being $4 a pound, as an example, you can push the price down to $2 a pound and make it reasonably competitive with the poultry integrators. Infrastructure is our major issue in Maryland. It's the number one problem. Infrastructure from processing to distribution. When you, I will offer it as an example, one of my coworkers at the University of Maryland East Shore was talking with a major distributor and with fresh produced, lettuces. And they said, we need 10 pallets to trial. There is not one farmer in the state of Maryland who is producing one pallet a week. Yeah. It's that part of the infrastructure to bring it to a central point, aggregate it to meet the demand. And we don't have that. And what CASA is doing and some private organizations are doing are looking at how we can make this system work. We're inventing it from scratch. It didn't exist in Maryland, but it's going to exist because of demand, and demand is what's driving it.
I'll just add real quickly that at the Maryland Food System Map Project at the Center for Livable Future, we've been really looking into this infrastructure issue, and we actually did a study on slaughter facilities, exactly what Errol was talking about, throughout the state. And the Eastern Shore and Southern Maryland in particular really don't have any options. So they're going to other states or just not doing it at all. And certainly, like, Baltimore City has such a rich history of canning and preserving foods, and a lot of that's been lost. And I think Errol's right. We're not going recreating what we're creating from scratch because it's a new time. We have new opportunities, but that infrastructure piece is crucial to growing this movement.
Yeah, I was going to echo what Errol said, but also the inspiration is there, and the young people are coming along who are inspired and want to see the food system change, and they are crafting and honing the skills that are necessary to to build this infrastructure that takes place. I mean, there's, you know, there are a lot of obstacles, you know, and but, you know, the knowledge obstacle is being overcome, and you know, Future Harvest and this network of farmers that are giving their experience and their knowledge to young people are overcoming that.
I mean, I think this is a question we've been asking here on Soundbites for a long time. I think it's an important segue this conference is going to take place with this conversation, because what you were describing, Errol, I mean, and other people have kind of been wrestling with about how you create a food hub, how you do, how you make this work, because right now, you know, the other farmers will say, well, that you guys are niche farmers. You sell to the elite, and that's it. And that's not what America needs. We need a new way of figuring out how to get our food, Errol.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That's one of the obstacles we have to overcome. The perception, I've heard it more than once from many folks that, well, good food, fresh food, is for the elite. It's the farthest thing from my brain. I want everyone, I believe everyone has the right to have fresh local food. And I've read more than one study when folks who are at the lower economic end, when they're interviewed and asked what they prefer, they want fresh local food. And often, too often, they don't have access to it because, one, they don't, their local grocery store is not offering it, or they don't have a place to buy it. It's, you know, you're 20 blocks away from a store in Baltimore City. That's a trek to,
right,
you know, pick it up and bring it home. So that's part of that infrastructure we have to work with. And the perception of elitism has to go away. And I think the only way we can make it go away is by offering the food at every opportunity, from the farmer's market. One of my coworkers sells at a church farmer's market. He's the only vendor there, but every church member shows up.
I just want to add that.
Thoughts, Amanda?
Sure. At the conference, you know, we realize that one size doesn't fit all. And so in order to make this work, we've got to build infrastructure at all different scales. So we need to concentrate on farmers markets, but also institutional sales. The Food System Project is also looking at farm to school, farm to hospital. But at the conference, we have a couple sessions on institutional sales, how to grow for wholesale, and then also how to make it work at a farmer's market level. And I think we're going to have multiple models out there. It's not just going to be one solution. So
absolutely. There is no one size fits all. Mm-hmm. I think I've argued over time that we need to look at institutional sales. We need to look at direct marketing models, and there are many, 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 many models. And we have to be creative, because no one's going to do it for us. When I say us, no one's going to do it for the consumer. No one's going to do it for the farmer. And the farmer has to do the hard, heavy lifting. Most farmers don't want to do that. They want to grow food.
Right. And I'll say, you know, that argument is, our response to that is, it's not the small-scale farmer's job to feed the entire world. It's the small-scale farmer's job to feed their community. And, you know, there needs to be more small farmers feeding their communities throughout the country.
Well, if you want more of this, join us this Saturday at Future Harvest CASA for its 15th annual Farming for Profit and Studio Show Conference. It's important for all of us to be actually part of this. It's our future. You can go to Future Harvest CASA, CASA.org. There's still time to register, and you can also walk in Friday and Saturday and just become part of the process. And you're welcome to join us in College Park. Again, go to futureharvestcasa.org. I want to thank our guests here this hour, Errol Maddox, Denzel Mitchell, and Amanda Behrens. Great to have the three of you here in the studio with us, or at least two of you, and have you with us by phone, Errol.
Thanks, Mark.
This is an important piece. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll be right back. Different take on GMOs. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Well, We're about to have another conversation about GMOs. And in our Looking Around Grist, which we often do, one of my producers found this piece written by Nathaniel Johnson. Two pieces, actually, in the series Looking at GMOs. He's a food writer for Grist. He teaches at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and is the author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. That's interesting. And Nathaniel Johnson is with us. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Nathaniel.
Thanks so much. It's also a quest for the world's longest subtitle. You did pretty well with that.
Thank you. Just only one stumble. So your own quest for this knowledge, I mean, about GMOs, and you've been anti-GMO, not really pro-GMO sojourn to find out what GMO means. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly started out with just kind of a feeling of, you know, that GMOs are part of industrial agriculture. There's not a whole lot of good that can come from them. And, you know, we're just mucking around with things that perhaps we shouldn't be mucking around with. But at the same time, it wasn't like I was that ardent in that position because I didn't know all the details. And so this, my editor said, why don't you really dig into this and find out what's real and what's not?
So one of the things you wrote about early was this, and that the General Mills choosing not to put non-genetically engineered material in their Cheerios, which is probably one of the world's first cereals, really, that we all ate as children when our parents didn't want us to have sugar.
Definitely the first there's nothing more mainstream than Cheerios.
But really?
That's sort of,
except maybe cornflakes.
Like, this is something that's tied up with mother's milk for, you know, it's probably more common than drinking breast milk is eating Cheerios when you're a kid. So this is something that's iconic. And so there is a big symbolic change in them choosing to go to label their original Cheerios non-GMO.
So, but how did this process start? I mean, there were clearly, I mean, they must have felt the pressure from activists and citizens who said that I want non-GMO cereals and I don't want GMO in my Cheerios, which is, you know, it's not like an off-brand, it's the brand. So what was the process here?
There's a couple big undercurrents going on. One of them, I mean, one more direct thing that I witnessed was back in, I think, October, I was on a conference call with these various activist groups who were announcing that they were going to try and target Cheerios to get them to do precisely this, to label themselves non-GMO and assure parents that there weren't any genetically modified ingredients in the cereal. And so, you know, while General Mills said that pressure didn't have anything to do with it, it is awfully, quite a coincidence that activists were targeting precisely this cereal, and this cereal has made this shift. So that's one thing, but I think there are some bigger political and economic forces moving things around right now.
We're talking with Nathaniel Johnson, who's the food writer for the online publication Grist. We have to take a very brief break, but please stay with us. We're going to come back with more in this conversation about GMOs and the politics surrounding them on all sides. Back in just a minute. Welcome back to Soundbites, our weekly show on food, agriculture, and the environment. I'm Mark Steiner, and our guest this segment is Nathaniel Johnson. He's the food writer for Grist, who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and he's been working on a series about GMOs, which we are speaking with him about right now. Before we went to break, we were talking about why General Mills made the decision to remove genetically modified ingredients from Cheerios. So you think it was a combination of community forces, activists saying we want a GMO-free Cheerio, and the corporate side saying what? That we're going to, they never said we're acquiescing to this from what you wrote, right?
Well, so the corporate side, we know that they've been realizing for a while now that they've got to do something. And we know this from leaked documents and documents that have been that have come available through lawsuits and discovery. And basically what they're saying is there are all of these labeling pushes around the country. All these different states are passing laws.
Or trying.
Well, there's, yeah, you know, Alaska now has a law to force the labeling of fish if they're genetically modified. A couple of states in the Northeast have passed laws, but they're all contingent upon getting a critical mass of states to pass a labeling law so that they're not just standing alone and, you know, being the first person to stick their head up over the trenches, you know, and get the lawsuit. So this is happening. You know, the corporate executives can see the writing on the wall. And so we know from these leaked documents that what they have been trying to do is to pass some kind of national law that would preempt these state laws and basically allow for set a national standard for voluntary labeling. And so they could label some of their foods and some, you know, they might find too hard. They wouldn't. It would get rid of all the pesky state laws, and it would allow them to do some things like Cheerios is doing, to experiment with putting these non-GMO labels on and seeing if that gets them more customers.
Yeah, and I wonder, exactly, I mean, that makes sense to me, your analysis of that. The other side, though, I wonder why it took so long, why it was so complex to find these non-GMO ingredients, whether it's oats, corn, or sugar, to put in the Cheerios in the first place. What does that say about all that?
That's another really interesting thing. And this is, it's something that I hadn't really understood. General Mills provided a little window into what was going on when they made this announcement. You know, Cheerios is not a genetically modified product. But we don't have commercially available genetically modified oats, which is what Cheerios are made of, you know, highly processed oats. But they're not genetically modified. The issue for them was two little ingredients. Cornstarch. There's a little cornstarch in Cheerios, and some of that they don't know. Some of it might be from genetically modified corn. Some of it's non-GMO, but they just didn't know. And sugar. So sugar from beets is often genetically modified. The beets are genetically modified. The sugar itself is refined, so it's probably not an issue. But still, sugar from cane, there's no genetically modified cane. So that's not an issue. So they just had to make this tiny little switch. But the problem is that we live in this society where everything gets mixed together. There are these huge industrial supply chains to get these foods from the field to the factories. And it's very hard to parse out of that one set of sugars or one set of cornstarch and make sure that it's not genetically modified. And so they said that this took them over a year just to do these very simple changes.
People oppose genetically modified organisms in their food in large part because they're opposed to kind of this corporate industrial agriculture that dominates our food in America and the world, but B, because people are saying that they don't know what will happen to the earth, what will happen to our bodies if we consume genetically modified organisms in our food, correct?
Right.
So tell me what you've learned about all that and what you're still wrestling with all this.
There's about a million different little angles that you can go down for this. So I'll start with one, but I just want to say that as a pretext, because it's such an emotional issue, and as soon as you bring up one issue, you know, even if people feel like you gave a good answer to that, you know, there's a dozen others that they want answers to. So if we take the health issue, for example, I started out this process by trying to go to people on both sides of the issue and see if I could find any points of agreement. As far as health goes, you know, people who are worried about GMOs in general, for example, the Union of Concerned Scientists, have been very critical in terms of trying to make sure that genetically modified organisms are safe. But scientists there said, look, I'm not really worried about the genetically modified foods that are already out there. those don't keep me up at night. There are new things coming down the pike that we need to assess and make sure they're safe as they come in. So there's a pretty widespread agreement that what's out there is probably okay. And when you look at the studies, there's been just a ton of science that's been done on all of these, and there are a few that suggest that show some association with various diseases, but they don't necessarily show that the genetically modified foods cause those diseases. It's a much more tangential type of thing. And when you zoom out from those are the ones that get all the press. And you look at all of the science that's been done on this. There are hundreds and hundreds of others that don't show those associations. And so it looks much more coincidental. You know, by the end of my research on safety, I started to feel very comfortable with eating genetically modified ingredients, the ones that we have out there, and feeding GMO filled Cheerios to my 2-year-old daughter.
So, just in conclusion, this particular conversation between us, it makes me think of this world between Bill Gates, who wants to change the entire international system of food with GMOs and things, really looks towards the industrialization of agriculture throughout the world and using GMOs to feed the world, which he thinks has to happen. And then Vandana Shiva on the other end, who says, no, this industrial agriculture and GMOs is the wrong way to go to feed our world. We need to go back to much more simpler ways of trading in our food and other goods with each other and growing our food, which we can do without the interference of industrial giants. I mean, that and the GMOs were in the midst of that argument.
Right. Yeah. I accept the larger dichotomy. I would say that Bill Gates's position is, you know, that the GMOs should be a part of the solution, but I don't think it's necessarily a cornerstone for him. So yeah, so there's certainly, and I see, you know, this is sort of what my book is about. You see this over and over again, where there's a group of people that's saying, let's boldly march forward into the future and into the light. And you have a group of people saying, every time we boldly march forward, we seem to trip and fall. You know, maybe it's time to take a few steps back and look at where we're going in the bigger picture. And I think that there's a way to do both. There are times when we need to take steps back, but I don't think any of us really wants to go back completely. You know, even if it sounds nice, you know, we're not going to give up antibiotics or all the creature comforts that we get from our food system. So the trick is figuring out how we can take these technologies that are really useful and adapt them into such a way that it promotes equality and environmental quality and health. And I think there is a way to do that if we're careful about it.
Well, Nathaniel Johnson, I really look forward to getting you back on the air with us and one-on-one and also in a kind of discussion with others around these issues from GMOs to antibiotics to what means natural and how we should grow our food. I appreciate this time. Nathaniel Johnson is food writer for Grist. He teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. And his book is All Natural, A Skeptic's Guide to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. And we are reflecting on the two pieces, on the series of pieces he wrote for Grist. Serial numbers, will GMO-free Cheerios capture the new market, and what I learned from my 6 months of GMO research, none of it matters. And we'll come back to this conversation with you. Thank you so much for taking your time with our listeners today.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Of course, you're listening to Soundbites here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn more about the important issues impacting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at marylandeducators.org. That's marylandeducators.org. Or you can also go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. It's right there. Our concluding conversation today on Soundbites is with Dr. Maureen Ogle, who is a historian. Our book before this was Ambitious Brew, The Story of American Beer. Her latest book we're about to talk to you about is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. And as a committed omnivore, I consume this book, no pun intended, and we're about to have a conversation with Maureen Ogle. And welcome to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
So now, one of the things you begin with saying that Americans love their meat, and that we've done so at least since the colonial period that gave Americans a chance to eat more meat they thought was possible to consume or grow.
That's right.
Or raise.
That's right. That's right. What sort of became the the guiding thematic device of the book was something I figured out pretty early on in the research, which was that during the colonial period, the people who settled what eventually became the United States encountered a world of what to them was just mind-boggling abundance. And they had come from a world where both land and food were scarce, namely Europe or England, Great Britain. But in North America, there was no one to say, hey, you can't have land, and hey, you can't eat meat. And so that's what they did, to the extent that they concluded very early on that the Native Americans already living here had no rights to the land because they did not keep domestic livestock. Native Americans didn't keep any domesticated animals. And the white Europeans who settled the Eastern Seaboard said, well, this land is ours, and what we're going to do is eat meat. And even before the American Revolution, the colonists were eating meat on a scale that visitors from Europe just found difficult to believe. They were eating it two or three times a day, which was absolutely unheard of in the old world.
Now, I mean, we do have this desire for meat, just like we have a desire for sugar. We have a desire for lots of things. I think that is a part of the human condition. And a desire for alcohol, a desire for beer, or whatever we can ferment. Most cultures are fermented, and that as well. But is it too much of a good thing? As I think about all the way in this book, I mean, yes, meat's really available. We made an industry in America that made it easy for us to consume meat because it's on the supermarket shelves. It's because of all the farm bills we've helped farmers through, so they survive the rough times, and it's lowered our prices of food in America to mind-bogglingly low. But is that necessarily good that we have this much access to meat? I kept wondering about that reading the book.
Well, that is the $64 million question. And as soon as you and I both answer it, we can retire and do whatever we want to do. This book I thought of as sort of the flip side of the beer book. The beer book, which came out in 2006, was sort of my love song to the notion of American opportunity. But I realized right away when I started the meat book that in a sense I was looking at the other side of the coin. If you think you're entitled to everything, if you have a sense of infinite possibility, which we Americans absolutely do, what happens when you think you can have all? And as I say, both in the introduction and the conclusion, it's not clear to me that we can keep having everything. We can't keep having five-bedroom houses out on the suburban fringe and $2 a pound ground beef and demand that we can get rid of in livestock confinement operations and industrial agriculture. We seem to want cheap food, but we don't really want to pay the price that the cheap food actually necessitates. And because we have so much cheap food, we think it's real easy to criticize our food system, which, is a conundrum I'm not quite sure how we're going to get out of. I don't think we can have it all.
Well, so that's why I was wondering this also as I was reading the book. I mean, so that's part of the contradiction, because one of the things that you kind of describe in the book and the way you approach it is the food system we have is one we've developed, but it's been critiqued a lot by those who you have said don't quite understand, like Michael Pollan and others, and Eric Schlosser have written books about our food system. But is that part of our issue here that is out of control? Do you know what I mean? I mean,
yes, absolutely, absolutely. That's why in the book I went into so much detail about the emergence of the consumer economy, because as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure many of your guests have tried to explain, the critique right now about food in America tends to revolve around the idea that big corporations have taken over our food system and they control what goes on in our kitchens, and therefore our food system is broken. The point I tried to make in the book was that it doesn't make any sense to blame corporations for this. We've got exactly the food system that we American consumers want. Americans have the cheapest food in the world, and God knows we've got plenty of it. And the fact that we have so much has makes it possible for us to be this critical. But if we really want to find the enemy here, we need to go look in a mirror instead of, you know, pointing at sort of vague corporate power. I think that the problem lies within us, which I think is the main reason it's going to be so difficult for us to create any kind of substantive change. The meat system, for example, has been built over one generation after another over the past 150 years to satisfy what Americans have demanded. So as long as we continue to have this extraordinary demand for meat, Americans eat on average about 225 pounds of meat a year, a fact that I find absolutely mind-boggling. And until that changes, we're going to continue to need the system that we have right now. So, you know, we got to make a choice. Which do we want here? A lot of cheap food, or are we willing to give something up in exchange for something that we think is better?
Well, there's a couple things I was thinking about when I was, as you were speaking also, that was from your book. And I, because there's a lot of argument over, people can argue over what creates a consumer's desires.
Right.
A consumer's desire or what we're given. But let me take this in two parts. Earlier in your book, you talk about Gus Swift.
Right.
And so when Gus Swift helped revolutionize the way we transport meat,
mm-hmm.
I don't think he envisioned the world we have today. He was figuring out how to get meat from out west from cattle ranchers who were growing their livestock and on grass ranges, slaughtering them, getting them there, to keep the meat from deteriorating before it got to market, and create this whole system. But I don't think he thought about what we ended up with now. It was a very different world in 1873, which is about the time he did this, right? 1870s?
Right. Well, it was actually in the late 1870s, but that's right. I mean, one of the points I tried to make, I didn't want to like shove this in people's faces while they're reading the book, but Gus Swift was clearly a very ambitious guy, clearly very entrepreneurial, and absolutely determined to earn money doing what he did. Now, I don't think any of us can argue that that's a bad thing, right? So he set out to do what in his mind would earn him the most return for his labor, which was give consumers what they wanted, which was a whole lot of low-cost meat. And the demand was so obvious that he and people like Phil Armour managed to overturn a system of livestock production and meat delivery that had been in place for a couple of hundred years, and they did that in less than a decade. So, it wasn't like he was some big corporate behemoth. He became a big corporate behemoth because he was giving people what they wanted. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. It's so easy just to blame faceless, nameless corporate bogeymen for everything. But then that, in effect, means that we're all witless dupes. We're all victims. And I'm just not buying that argument.
Well, there's another piece in another book that I read. There was about a group called the Meat Price Investigators Association, which was a group formed by hundreds of feedlot operators and cattle ranchers out west. And one of the quotes from one of the pieces they say there is that the supermarkets control the ultimate consumer demand for beef by the specials they feature in their meat departments. If the wholesale price of beef threatens to move higher, then they lessen the demand for beef by either raising their prices to a level where consumers hesitate to buy or feature other items such as poultry, ham, etc. So in some ways, our desires are what is thrown at us that kind of feed on what we really want. And there's always been this constant battle between ranchers and beef growers and those who process and sell it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That, you know, I can't get too excited about any of the current arguments about how, you know, ranchers are being ripped off or whatever, because those arguments have been made over and over. And I mean, I've been reading, I read about those, you know, 150 years ago. So that's right. But one point I will make that you brought up, and rightly so, that really surprised me when I was working on the book, was just how much power grocery chains developed in the 1920s and 1930s, because they represented the front line of consumer demand. They were grocery chains were the ones who were figuring out what it is people would buy and wouldn't buy, and grocery chains in turn translate those, or you know, transmit those demands onto meat packers, who in turn pass them on to the actual farmers, the ranchers, the livestock producers at the, you know, at the agricultural end. So it's true that grocery chains play a crucial role in all this, in making demands on food processors, but grocery chains are responding to what's going on right there on the front lines in their stores. They're watching what consumers are buying, and they've been doing that for almost 100 years. They're very powerful players, but it doesn't mean that they're manipulating our demand. They're responding to our demand.
Oh, so I think that's always been the debate. Is it manipulation of demand or responding to demand?
Well, I don't regard myself as a witless stoop, and I realize this can make me very unpopular with a lot of people who are listening to this, but I just flat out don't believe that my desires are controlled. Are there plenty of weird people in the world who buy stuff that's not necessary? Of course. I just saw a staggering example. I went to a Target yesterday for the first time in about a year, and I saw a device for making breakfast sandwiches, and all I could think was, who in God's name needs a device for making breakfast sandwiches? Well, clearly somebody out there is dumb enough to buy it, but that doesn't mean that their desires are being manipulated. That just means there's a sucker born every minute, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me ask you a question before we run out of time, because there's so much here. Maybe we'll get you back another day for a roundtable, because I think this is fascinating, the stuff you raised, but it's a huge debate again, and that has to do with in your book, looking at from the very beginning of things like DES, the synthetic hormone, and where we've come to today in terms of antibiotic use, and all these reports you're reading from the government and other places about both the dangers of what it does to our resistance, what happens to the environment, but you seem to like think that it's overblown. Am I misreading you?
No, it's not that I think it's overblown. I think that people who are condemning of antibiotics, and by the way, that would include the vast majority of livestock producers who are none too happy about having to use them themselves. I was just trying, in the book, I'm just trying to explain historically why it is that livestock producers began using things like confinement, antibiotics, hormones. They didn't use it. They didn't start using it because they were being, you know, sort of led by their noses by big corporations. It was because there was a severe labor shortage and farmers needed to replace lost labor. And these things, believe it or not, actually helped them do that. This is back in the 1940s. So if we look at the historical context, it can help, I think, make more sense of these very, very complicated arguments. It's just too simple to say, oh man, those awful corporations are ruining us. Let's look at why farmers did this in the first place and then ask ourselves if we can come up with a different way of doing things.
Well, Maureen Ogle, I really want you to come back for a larger conversation. This is just one of our quick book interviews where we do these things in great depth, and look forward to you coming back. The book is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America by Maureen Ogle. Maureen, thank you so much for your time, and please do rejoin us.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks for having Nathaniel Johnson on, man. I think that guy is the best thing to happen to the food debate in a long time.
He's fascinating.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Bring him back.
We will.
Bring us both back together.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. You've been listening to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites. That's brought to you in part by MeetCube, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeetCube, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeetCube invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. to podcast this show, find out about our guests and the work that they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.